All right, hey everybody. Welcome. Good to see you. This is the final Q&A call for this round of SBSM. With me are my lovely team members, Mara and Susan. Thank you for being here. They'll be helping out in the chat. I got 15 very different questions for the most part for this call. And so I'm just going to answer all 15 individually. Some are kind of entirely out of the scope of our program, but kind of interesting. So I just left them in there since figured, heck, why not? It's the last call. So we will get started. Just a note that I will, at the end of the call, if you do stick around, I'm going to do a sort of just a brief group neurosensory visualizing practice that I sometimes like to wrap up with on the last call. So if you can stick around for that, we'll be doing that at the end. Alrighty. Okay, so hello, alumni here of 4 years, and I've had a lot of great things happen with this work in terms of regulation and capacity. When I get touch work done, or I do some diaphragm work in the labs, for example, a lot does come up now, and it can take some time for my system to come back to homeostasis. I do have the capacity to handle it, but it can take me a week or several weeks to return to normal. I'm struggling to find a way to move into the deeper aspects of this work, even with titration. Any advice or tips? You bet. So, the first thing I'll say is that it actually sounds like you already are on a really good trajectory to organically just allow that to happen. Because what you describe here of you're slowly growing regulation and capacity. You have the capacity now to receive physical work, touch work. You can go into the diaphragms and work with what comes up. And yeah, I hear you. Like it's a deal, you know, like you have some stuff to process there. But then you come back after a week or so, maybe a little bit more, to feeling relatively normal. So awesome. Like that is really, really good. Now, the fact that it takes a week or more does tell me that you're still growing capacity. Because generally speaking, when we just process a piece of trauma, say, usually if we're like at really strong capacity, it's going to take more like a day or maybe 2 or 3 days to come back to homeostasis. A week or more, fine. It just tells us that the system still is gaining in resiliency and capacity to like sort of expand and come back and reconfigure and do all the stuff that it does. So really good. I mean, just keep on doing what you're doing. In terms of little other things you could explore, I'm glad you mentioned titration. So please keep that in mind with any of the things I'm about to suggest, because everything I'm about to suggest can potentially ping deeper into the system and stir up some stuff. So one is Feldenkrais. So the Feldenkrais practices, the neurosensory practices, mostly in labs 9 and 10, the more advanced Feldenkrais practices, those can really stir up some stuff for a lot of people because of the way in which Irene asks us to pay attention in those practices. And the movements themselves are often kind of tapping into developmental layers. So ways in that we move when we're babies, and sort of laying on our back, exploring the environment, looking around, moving our limbs with curiosity. Feldenkrais taps into a lot of that stuff, or can. So those practices, I don't have them up in front of me. Maybe I'll just do that real quick, just so I can name exactly. But it's mostly in lab 9 and 10 where we find the bulk of these more advanced ones. So for example, so actually starting in lab 8, even lab 7, lesson 3, gentle head rolling is a little bit more of a Feldenkraisian lesson. And then lab 8, lesson 1, mini balance your back, lesson 2 and 3, connecting the head and the pelvis. Those are both really powerful Feldenkrais lessons. And also rolling like a baby in lab 9. The bell hand lesson in lab 9 is a doozy. It's deceptively simple, but if you really tune into what she's asking you to do, it promotes a very deep change in the system. So those are all ways to potentially dig in a little deeper into the more advanced stuff. Again, of course, with those lessons, keeping in mind your impulse, listening to your body. Do you feel like you need to process something that comes up during the practice? Please do press pause, etc. Other ways to consider, or other things I should say to consider, are there ways in which you can bring the practices more into your everyday life? So remembering that at the end of the day, all of these neurosensory practices are intended to be eventually just somatic tools that you have at your disposal, all the time, and that you go to organically. So how might you support that? Are you remembering in the grocery store to orient? Are you feeling your feet? Are you remembering potent posture? Are you breathing? Are you holding tension in your throat? Are you holding tension in your jaw? Right? All the ways which you can check into yourself in a day-to-day way that isn't about listening to an audio lesson. It's like, am I remembering to use these tools in real life, moment to moment? Are you listening to your impulses? These types of things. And then another thing you could look at, are there elements of your life that still need to be addressed? So are you happy with your work? Are there relationships that need addressing? Is there someone that you're hanging out with that you're realizing, oh man, I'm really not enjoying my time with them. That's kind of an energy suck, but I don't know. I feel like they're dependent on me and now I don't want to break up. Like, is there any weird relational dynamics that need addressing in your life? Are you happy with your work or do you want to find a different kind of work? What's your living situation like? Is that supportive enough? What's your exercise like? Are there ways that you can push your system that have nothing to do with trauma work on the surface? For example, exercising more intensely, walking more, getting more out into nature. These are all ways in which you can deepen, especially when you combine moment-to-moment awareness with somatic qualities, you can deepen your regulation, your capacity, your resilience, and what you have access to in yourself. And the only other thing I can think of is you can, if you want, choose, if you're not already, to start working with specific memories. So, are there things, events in your life that you know are still unresolved? Because if you start to think about them, you get really activated. Or if something appears in your life that looks like something from the past, do you get flashbacks? Do you get highly activated, easily triggered? If there are specific memories and events that you know are unresolved, then you could start to work specifically with memory as a way to get deeper into the system. And that sometimes can be helpful with a practitioner. That's another thing you can explore for going deeper. You can also do it on your own. Review if you didn't see the call on shock trauma last week, go watch that. Because I talk about something called T-model, which is all about working with specific events and memories, which you can do on your own and you can also do with someone else. So those are all different suggestions for helping you get into the deeper aspects of yourself and this work. Okay. From an SPSM's perspective, what is driving people to mass shootings, violent stabbings, murdering their parents? These seems to be a growing issue in America, especially. People are moving beyond arguing and estrangement to murder. What the heck is going on in their nervous system? So I'm assuming this was prompted by the horrible tragedy with Rob Reiner and his wife and son. Yeah. I think there's a few levels to this answer. At a broad picture, what we're witnessing is the inevitable culmination of generations of unresolved trauma. I mean, big picture wise, that's all that's going on. Centuries of unexpressed, unfelt, unprocessed trauma. And it's not like it gets weaker with time, like it snowballs. And the weight on the next generation is heavier and heavier as we go. So is the opportunity for healing and transformation and growth, right? The more stuff you get handled to process, the more potential treasure you have once you do so, in terms of wisdom and internal experience and emotional capacity and all these wonderful gifts that doing this work brings. If you don't do this work and you don't look at your stuff, it gets worse and worse and worse. And I think that's what we're seeing on a societal level. That being said, there are some specific things that are aggravating that. So our, current culture does not exactly support regulation. And more, we're going away from being, slow, introspective, reading, taking time to think, process, settle. We are just saturated in instant gratification culture, right? So that is very easy to just keep oneself at the surface level of things, go to the next, to the next, to the next. Just the sheer amount of exposure to tragedy in the world. Like we are not, our nervous system is not, as generally speaking, as humanity, is not evolved to process an entire world's worth of events. Our nervous system evolved to process our local tribe. And that's where still where we're at. We are not, as a species, ready to handle things like smartphones. We are not, as a species, ready to handle things like social media. And all of these things have become more and more and more confusing, And now with AI-generated content and the way that people are using that to just invent shit, it's like it's such a confusing world that's meaningless in a lot of ways. That doesn't really offer the human being much of anything other than a little dopamine hit. So that is not a culture that supports people slowing down and asking questions and working on their trauma and coming to regulation. So, along with that snowball, we have this culture that really supports people staying in their trauma. So that doesn't, work out well for the most part, and that's what we're seeing. There's a final piece that is interesting to consider. Environmental toxicity also can play a role. I actually just listened to this really interesting podcast. One of my favorite podcasts is called 99% Invisible. It's about design, the human-built world, which may sound boring, but it's actually fascinating. And one of the most recent episodes was about a woman who she had written a book called Murderland, because she grew up in Seattle area in the 70s and 80s, where there was this tremendous string of serial killers. And she made the connection to the incredible amount of lead and arsenic that was in the environment at the same time due to really unregulated smelting in the area. And there is a direct correlation to the level of lead and arsenic and violent serial killer activity. And as soon as that plant got shut down, it just went off a cliff in terms of violence in the area. So she didn't have enough evidence to say, look, this is directly proof. But there is a strong relationship there that was shown between environmental toxicity, heavy metals specifically, and people's tendency towards volatility, irrationality, explosiveness, inability to control their rage, all of that stuff. And we do know that heavy metals have a profound impact on the brain and the endocrine system. So, yeah, lots of different factors to consider in the answer to that question. Bottom line, we have to do this work as humanity. Maybe, it doesn't mean humanity has to go through smart body, smart mind, although of course we'd be a fan of that. But we need to do nervous system work as a species. We have to learn about ourselves and how to navigate this world we're in at the nervous system level, because we're not built for it. So we can thrive and succeed and be, full of vitality and life and health, but it really takes working at this level. So spread the word, folks. It's the thing to do. All right. Hi, I'm an alumni. I have early developmental trauma, and reading was an important way to escape during my childhood. I still love reading, but after doing more of the healing work myself, I see how enmeshed I became with the characters in the book and their feelings. I've had to take a break from reading because it dysregulates me so much. How can I return to my reading in a healthy way? So, I completely relate to this question. I was super into fantasy and science fiction from an early age and absolutely used it as in the same way. Now, I'd like to consider a slightly different perspective here. You are dysregulated and you're engaging with the fiction and the characters therein and their emotional processes because it's a way to have relationships and an emotional life that's safe. So this is actually a resource, or it has been. Now, what it sounds like has happened is you've done enough work that now you're seeing how you're getting caught up in those emotions and those journeys, and it's actually not the best for you because it sounds like maybe you have more of your own emotional life, more safety in relating to yourself and other real people in your environment. And you're seeing how, wow, this really stirs me up. But I think probably for a long time, if you're any similar to me, it probably was a resource for you, I'm going to guess. And that's just a logical assumption, but I'm guessing it really felt great to escape into those books as you were growing up. So I think that it's moved, it sounds like it's moved from being a resource and a way to have a safe emotional life and relationships to realizing, oh, this is actually, generating emotions and internal drama that I don't really need. So, okay, great. And then, yeah, that means that it is time to have a shift in how you relate to your reading. So, taking a break is a great idea. While you're doing that, I would encourage you to look at what are your real relationships like. Is there any way that you can take more advantage of safe people and safe relationships in your life, in a way that is going to serve you, feed you emotionally in the same way that the books have been? Meaning, how can you get more richness and interaction from real life? So that you are starting to fill in what that has been doing for you, because it's not really doing it for you so much anymore. Another thing to consider is what if you just completely read something different? So I don't know what you don't say what you've been reading, but I mean, it sounds like you're reading probably either fiction, or maybe very rich biographies or something, because you're talking about how the emotions and the characters and everything are stirring up a lot for you. So it doesn't sound like you're reading textbooks. It sounds like there's some story, some character development, some relationships happening. So what would it be like to read like a book by Peter Levine, or Bessel van der Kolk's The Body Keeps the Score, or Gabor Mate, or any books in the trauma field? There's lots of good ones. My favorites by Peter that I think everyone should read are In an Unspoken Voice, which is his second book, and Trauma and Memory is one of the lesser known ones that is actually really, really good and helpful to understand. What would that be like just to read totally different stuff that isn't about characters and relationships and drama? Another thing to consider, if you do return to reading at some point, is to have like a dedicated reading time that has a container around it. This is something that I did, since I was prone to just escaping as you were. As the years went by and my relationship with reading changed and evolved, now I just have like, morning coffee time is where I read. 15, 20 minutes, maybe a half hour. That's it. And so there's like this container around it. And I don't mind. For me now, it's like I love really good fantasy and science fiction. I love literature as well, but like, yeah, really well-written fantasy or science fiction, I love that stuff. And it's no longer a problem for me I'm not like living my emotional life through the book anymore. But I still like to have a container around it because just I know I have a tendency towards escapism. So, all different ideas. Okay, this is an interesting one. AI is unavoidable. Let's talk about how to healthily incorporate it into somatic work. I was averse to AI, realized my resistance, began to explore, and found some models that were aiming to be non-extractive and meta-relational, and proceeded with caution. I now engage with ChatGPT-5 and had extraordinary helpful conversations around many issues of mine that arise from nervous system work, and the responses have been profound, insightful, and co-regulating. It brings me clarity and articulation. So believe it or not, this is not new to me. I've been hearing, I've heard from maybe this is the fourth or fifth person where they have used a AI model to do actual nervous system work or get accurate feedback that was really helpful. Now, the reason for this is because there's a couple things. One, when we're talking about AI, we don't actually currently have anything that is true AI, intelligent. What we have right now available to the public is basically a really big search engine combined with a large language learning model. So what it can do is filter through all like the web, and it can filter that, and it can formulate a response that sounds human, compassionate, empathetic. That's the combination of those functions. So it's not actually like intelligent in that it's creating its own thoughts at this point. And so if we look at it in that way, well, that's exactly kind of the best use for it. It depends on what it's fed, right? So if your model has learned Gabor Maté, Peter Levine, polyvagal theory by Stephen Porges, Bessel van der, if it's read all these books, and it can give you an accurate response. One person actually sent me a transcript of their whole interaction, and I read it and I was like, damn, yeah, that's more attuned and accurate than many human practitioners that I've seen and interacted with, seen, witnessed. So yes, it does have a role potentially. We are actually currently exploring some possibilities and ways we might use it with our vast resource of input. So, for example, years and years and years of Q&A calls and training calls, we've been exploring maybe there are some ways that we can use this technology to like make that database more searchable, which is something that we may be bringing, into the future. So, yeah, there are potential uses that can be good. It's not all just doom and darkness. So, yeah, thanks for that observation. Well, so this is a totally aside, but I don't know, I'm feeling compelled to share this. I had the same kind of thing with AI, like, I don't want anything to do with that. I'm, organic human person here, hippie from the woods. So I totally avoided it for a long time. And then, like this person, I had to sort of look at that, like, well, okay, it's not going away. Let's what look at I sh maybe I should explore something with it and just see what is my actual experience. How does it feel? At the time, my band was releasing an album, so I decided to explore using it to create a music video. And it was a fascinating process. I really liked what I created in partnership with this software I was using, and it was all AI stuff. We're not using it, but it was an interesting process. And what I discovered in the process of that is that it felt to me, and this is going away from somatic work and a bit into kind of spirituality, but like anything, it's a vibration, it's a frequency. And it felt to me like there was a positive aspect and a negative aspect. And I actually had this really interesting experience where I was creating this video, and I changed my intention about what I was creating. I was like, oh, let's actually make the story about this. And it was a more redemptive theme. It was more like in alignment with trauma work and healing and Mother Earth. And in the next video that got generated or film frame after I changed my intention, all of a sudden this like female fairy appeared spontaneously in the image. So I was like, okay, there's something going on here. There's something happening where there's some depth to this. There's something interesting here. So just a random thing, but I thought that was fascinating. Okay. I have chronic neck and back pain that really affects my life. I've noticed how often I tense my back or shoulders, in part due to dysfunctional movement patterns, but I don't know how to stop doing this. I've been working with a postural therapist for a while, but I'm wondering if I'm struggling to make change due to a nervous system component. Is there anything you could recommend to help me with this? So, yeah, when we have a chronic tension pattern, so this isn't just a sore muscle from a workout or something. This is areas where they're always tense for as long as we can remember sometimes. That is directly related to the nervous system almost always. Now, yes, that's cool. You're looking at postural stuff. It also is related to that, but our posture is also related to our nervous system state, right? How we carry ourselves is directly related to how we feel about ourselves and what we're holding inside in terms of unresolved trauma. Specifically with tension, almost always what is related from a nervous system lens is the old incomplete procedural memory or incomplete self-protective responses, also bracing patterns or habitual unconscious forms of self-protection. So it could be that your house was really scary and your shoulders and your back was always up because you were just waiting to be screamed at, or you were waiting to be attacked in some way. It could be that this is from a specific trauma where your shoulders and arms really needed to do something to protect yourself, but you couldn't. And so that action is still wanting to happen. So the way to investigate this from a somatic lens is to allow the tension. When you notice the tension, don't try to soften it. Actually allow it, notice it, welcome it. And see if you can discover what is it trying to do. So, for example, say it's your shoulder is always like this. It has a tendency just to creep up, and you have to constantly, stop that. Okay, I'm gonna catch it, and instead of letting go, I'm just gonna let it be there. And what happens if I actually if I increase it? Is there a trajectory? Oh, I'm moving like this. Okay, that, and I'm gonna come back a little bit. Titration, right? Explore. Reversibility. These are Feldenkraisian principles also. Okay, that's something. Okay, let it go. Orient a little bit. Okay, now what if I come back? What if I come back to it? Yeah, okay, it's still there. Oh, I see. If I keep following it, my elbow starts to lift. Oh, what? My arm, and now my head wants to turn, right? So this is all the stuff that you discover by really tuning into your impulses. Where we talk about follow your impulse, and we start about, just the basics, biological impulses, pee when you need to pee, drink water when you're thirsty, etc. The more you honor your impulses, the more refined they can communicate to you. So you start to really be able to hear things like, oh, as I follow this tension, there is an impulse to turn. And then you follow that. And then again, maybe you bring it back, you let it go, you go back to it. This is how we explore chronic tension patterns in this work. We try to discover if we allow it to happen, is it trying to do something? So if that's the case, we're talking about incomplete procedural memory, incomplete self-protective response. The body tried to do something, but it couldn't, and it's still trying to do that thing. That almost always results in chronic tension. The other thing is bracing patterns. Those sometimes have less information about what they're trying to do because they're not, they're kind of, you're just kind of armoring up, right? You're not like necessarily trying to push away. You're just tightening up, armoring up. But generally speaking, if it's a bracing pattern and we start to feel into it, there's usually a lot of emotion there. There's usually a lot of some kind of high intensity emotion. So you can explore that with breath, with bringing in expansion into the area that's tense. You can explore it via intention, and attention, just feeling, holding space. And you could also explore it with various forms of manual work, which you could also do yourself. Rolling on a ball, rolling on a fascial roller, various ways that you can start to explore, like getting some physical pressure into there if you don't want to go to a practitioner necessarily. So those are all different things to explore. Sometimes it may be useful to do some one-on-one work with a good somatic practitioner. If it does feel like, yeah, something wants to happen, but I can't quite figure it out, that's one of the things that we're trained to spot and say, hey, have you noticed, like, what your arm is doing there? Or like, that's part of what our skill set is, to like see, oh, I can see that you're trying to do this. And so that may be useful as well. And finally, there can sometimes be some usefulness later on with Feldenkrais again, just learning different movement patterns, learning how you do what you do, which is really what Feldenkrais is about, discovering what you do and how you do it, and then other options, different ways that are more efficient, that are more healthy. That's another thing to explore, but there's no use exploring Feldenkrais generally until the incomplete procedural memory, bracing patterns, etc., have been resolved. This is why Irene went into the trauma work, because she was doing Feldenkrais great with some people, but other people, nothing changed. Or something would change great in the session, and then next week it was exactly the same, because Feldenkraisian rewiring generally is too subtle and refined to get in there and unresolve these tension patterns if it's about trauma and the body needing to survive in some way. So. Can you please explain more about eye of the needle therapy that was mentioned on one of the previous calls? I was sexually abused as a 3-year-old and dissociated from the event until adulthood. The experience of having two different worlds that are contrasting keeps repeating to me. I wonder how to connect my life to be more whole and to discern the safety in a more coherent way, not to overexpect it, and on the other hand, to be hyper vigilant. Yeah. So it sounds like there's two, you, there's, you're now aware of like two different selves perceiving the world, your adult self and then your little 3-year-old self who is just coming back online. And of course, the 3-year-old self is going to be very distrustful, hypervigilant, and the other adult self may be in reaction to that. It may be over-trusting sometimes, actually, or over-eager for attachment or connection. There's lots of ways it can show up, but it sounds like you're having two different experiences based off of the way in which you sort of separated from yourself as a young person. And I actually wouldn't recommend eye of the needle work for this, at least right now. I will tell you, I will talk about it, but I think it may be more useful at this point to really build somatic connection with that 3-year-old. So, holding space and intending that self to be present is sometimes just enough, even just while orienting, inviting the 3-year-old to look out your eyes. What's it like for her? Feeling where is she in your body? Just touching, holding, making, holding, connecting, sending good intentions, working with the kidney adrenal system, those early, threat responses that would have happened, building regulation, building capacity, building relationship with that really young self would be best to do, I think, right now. So, that being said, what eye of the needle work is for reclaiming parts of ourself that are stuck in a dissociative state. So, I understand why you're asking, because that could apply. More often, this is used for surgical trauma, when someone was literally anesthetized out of their body, and while something was happening to their body that was very distressing, even if it was life-saving and crucial. So it's usually used for surgical trauma or for, yeah, an attack where maybe you were knocked unconscious and assaulted. That's generally how I've seen it used. I could see, though, how it could potentially be used in the situation you describe. Essentially, what it is Peter's adaptation of a shamanic journey, essentially, while the practitioner acts as a tether. So, in a session, if a practitioner is doing this work, there is a way we hold the calves usually of the legs, and we start doing this squeezing rhythm that is in rhythm with the client's breath. And there's a certain way to squeeze with the breath such that it encourages them to go in or out, as it may be, into the etheric realms where that dissociated piece is hanging out. And then at a certain point, we will change the squeezing rhythm to be instead of the inhale, it's with the exhale. And this then can encourage the person to come back. And it's not always one or the other. It kind of depends. You sort of follow your intuition on which is right for the each person. So it's not like, don't take that as a rule, but it's some kind of squeezing with the breath in or out in coordination that helps them sort of do that journey. And the squeezing and the presence of the somatic practitioner is a tether to keep them grounded partially here and now while they go and discover the parts of themselves that is still hanging out in the ethers. So it's something that would be very tough to do on one's own, because it's about having that tether. The only way that you could potentially explore this on your own, although I don't recommend doing it now, I think before you do any kind of this more shamanic work, you want to really, like I said, focus on working in the body and seeing if you can build relationship with the perceptions of that early self, the emotions of that early self, because it's possible you don't actually need this work and it could be overstimulating. But if one were to try this kind of shamanic work, you need a tether. And so one thing that is traditionally used from the shamanic realms is the drum. So you can get a shamanic drumming recording. There's lots on YouTube, and you would use that as your tether. And there's a series of signals that are used, the shamanic drumming, while the journeying is typically very, very fast drum beat, usually for about 20, 30 minutes. And then it's usually ends with four very much slower, loud notes to call you back. There's different ways, but that's kind of a standard one. So that is something you could try if you were so inclined, but again, I recommend working in the body first to really build relationship with that young physiology and self. Hello, my question regards hoarding. There is an intergenerational trauma where my nan grew up in poverty without a mother and an alcoholic father. Once married, she was out of poverty and would bulk buy everything and hardly throw any containers away in case we might need them. This survival energy was passed down to my mom and me. I'm aware, but still feel guilty over throwing containers away like I'm doing something wrong. So, yeah, this is a classic intergenerational inheritance pattern that's been passed down to you. So it's with these things, it sounds like there's a surface presentation, which is the guilt. Like I feel a little guilty throwing this away. And that's like way up here on the surface. So if you want to, if it's useful and you need to work on this, then you want to find what's deeper in the waters there. And what that's going to be is terror. Survival terror is what's at the root of this. So it's not just a guilt thing. It's like, oh my God, I have to keep everything or I'll die. It's not going to be logical in any way, the root of this. And there's no way to know whether or not you actually have that within you or not. You may get a little, as I answer, as you hear this answer, does something stir in you? That's maybe a little bit of information as to whether this is there or not. Because it could just be a behavioral pattern and a surface level thing for you. And all you have to do is just, okay, yep, there's that guilt, and yep, that's just my grandma. I don't need that. A cognitive approach could potentially work for this. However, If you did really inherit and there is an unresolved thing in there, it's going to be survival terror. And so that's what you want to kind of sniff around and look for in your system. And the way you can do that is really when the next time this guilt surfaces, pause and just really sit with it. Treat the act of throwing that container away as a neurosensory practice. As that guilt comes, what do you actually feel? Is it just in your mind, like, oh, I shouldn't be doing this? Or is there like a visceral thing going on? And if there's a visceral thing going on, then you follow that and see what you find. And yeah, at the end of the day, this is about survival terror. And just as an added note, like this is kind of total surface level, but you said throwing away containers, there's guilt. I mean, you can recycle them. I don't know if that's what you mean, but if you're just throwing away and there's an option to recycle, then you could try that. I don't, that's, total surface level answer, but it could be a component that might be useful. I don't know. Hello, this is my second round, and I have early developmental trauma and ME/CFS. This is a chronic fatigue syndrome. Is it possible to work with healthy aggression if I can't really feel the connected emotions and sensations? Now and then, I have a lot of angry thoughts, but when I stop the thoughts and try to feel the emotions, I normally don't feel anything. This also applies to other emotions unless they are very strong. Okay. So, with early developmental trauma and the fact that you have chronic fatigue, this points to yes, your system got dysregulated very early on, and you're still building up the capacity within you to have full range of access to all your emotions, which is totally normal. It's actually not a bad thing right now that you can't fully feel all the emotions and sensations of your anger. That's your body protecting you. Because if you still have chronic fatigue, that means you don't have a ton of capacity yet. So that's not a bad thing. Your system's trying to protect you from that high voltage because really feeling aggression and rage is a high voltage state. It's a lot of electricity moving through the system. And if your wiring isn't yet robust enough to really handle it, you don't really want to feel all of that yet. It's a good thing that you're not. So you can, however, start to build those pathways, build those capacities. And what you can do is you just work with the surface level. You work with the affect and the musculature. And don't worry about if you really feel it or not. It doesn't really matter so much right now. I think when you notice that you're angry, you're having angry thoughts, then just what does it feel like just to squeeze your fists a bit? And maybe you press with your feet a few times and then you just let it go. What happens? Do you feel a little heat? Great. Okay. Awesome. Leave it. Maybe you feel nothing. No worries. Leave it. That's fine. Or maybe you notice you're having angry thoughts and you just let your lip raise a bit and you narrow your eyes and then you let it go. And what was that like? You just start exploring with the expression, the facial expressions of anger, and the musculature that's associated with anger, which is about self-protection, ultimately, right? So our fists, our arms, our teeth, our jaw, our legs as well. Feel what it's like to use those muscle groups to squeeze a little bit, to mobilize a little bit, and then let it go. Just little bits like that can help your system start to see, like, oh, we're working together here. There's anger present, and it's not just staying in the thoughts. Okay, there's the bits of the body associated with anger are starting to be mobilized. Cool. That's probably the best way right now. Let's have a little pause. Go get some water or have a pee break or whatever. If you need to walk around, go away from the screen, whatever. We'll be back in a few minutes. Alrighty, welcome back. Self-blame and trauma. Lately, a strong word of self-blame appeared that I seem to need to be working on. Can you say some words with your own or professional experience on this and which emotions it relates to, as it does not seem to be too much of a bodily emotion, but more of a concept? Okay, well, I don't know what the word is. So I can't say for sure, but it sounds like it's something along the lines of I suck in some way, if it's self-blame. So there's a two possibilities here. One, maybe it is the mental representation of something that is very much in the body and deep, so deep that you're not feeling it, but it's I've been allowed to surface up into your mind. And that is often how it may go. When something, a certain state, especially something like what's at the root of this, which is toxic shame, is so painful to feel, the body will repress it, the mind will repress it. And then as we start to do some work, like maybe we start to get some information about what we're holding in the form of thoughts, words appearing in our heads, etc. But those are just the surface fish, and there's a big, much bigger whales down deep. So that's one possibility for sure. If that's the case, then what you're talking about is toxic shame. I mean, any form of I suck is toxic shame. So that is what it would be if it is in fact a deeper thing. And we've talked tons on these calls about how to work with that. I'll refer you to the YouTube video discussed the gateway emotion for processing toxic shame. Essentially, the body doesn't feel good holding toxic shame. It feels gross. Another podcast I listened to, someone had a really good explanation, or just I liked the way they phrased it as a total contraction of the self, where just your entire self just is contracted into a pit and you kind of want to disappear from the world. That's toxic shame. And it feels gross at a visceral level. It's like, eh, right? Ugh. And that is how we generally work with it once we can start to find it. If it's in there, it's going to be somewhere in the area of the viscera, in the collapse across the shoulders. The tailbone will be tucked. There's a whole posture of toxic shame that will likely be accessible if that's something that is ready to move through your system over time. So that's what you would be looking for. One way to explore this intentionally is as you hear the word and you tune your attention to your body, what happens if you just intentionally tuck your tailbone and drop your shoulders a bit? Do you start to get some feeling that stirs in there? Or no, maybe not. And also just have patience, if it's ready, it'll arise on its own over time. You can, with your intention and attention, hold space for it in these ways. The other possibility, is that this is just a mental echo of something that's actually been resolved, which also can happen. We can work through a lot of stuff. And at the nervous system, emotional, bodily, physical level, it's been cleared. But the mind still has associated patterns of thought that can pop up. You can sort of tell if it's one or the other based on have you done that deep toxic shame processing. And if you have, then this is most likely, or just an echo, or maybe there's a little bit more to do. Or my sense is, and this is probably a little bit more likely, is it's actually unresolved still, this deep toxic shame charge in the body. And you just need to hold space for it, hold your intention, your attention, and invite it to surface, which it will do when it's ready, if that's the case. I began struggling with insomnia 10 years ago. SBSM improved my sleep, but since moving a month ago, it has worsened. Noises from neighbors trigger hypervigilance, even with earplugs, as the challenge is internal. Orienting, containment, adrenal dropping exercises all help, but I still struggle to feel safe within myself. Do you have suggestions for restoring a sense of safety and improving sleep? So, I mean, you're already doing the things I would suggest. Also, please know that this is totally normal. Anytime you move to a new living situation, it can take a while for the system to adjust. And there's so many things, the scents, the sounds of the environment, the light patterns. When you're in a new place, there's all new set of stimuli, and your body has to, it takes time to normalize these things and realize, oh, this novelty is not threat. Because if we think back to the biology of stress videos, for all mammals, novelty is the thing that produces an orienting response, right? The initial assessment of, is this dangerous? If we have a predisposition towards hypervigilance because of unresolved trauma, and we've maybe worked through it quite a bit, and then we move, that natural tendency to orient towards novelty can poke at our system and put us back into a little bit more hypervigilance than we're used to. Again, it's just normal. It just can take some time. Even without trauma, being in a new environment can sometimes take time. So just give yourself some time to adapt, and time and familiarity will almost certainly help a lot. You're already doing the down-regulating practices that I would suggest to work with your system to help it feel safer. Awesome. Be sure to do those also, like when you're not feeling scared, for just as proactive practices during the day. The only other possibility that I can think of that may be useful here is that maybe there is a new, something that's ready to move through your system here. It's not just only the environment and old predispositions towards hypervigilance. Maybe this move has opened up or unpacked a deeper layer of sympathetic activation, and it just needs to be processed. So, and if that's the case, of course, remember sort of the two fundamental tenets of this work. Do we move towards settling, resourcing, orienting, containing, downregulation, or do we go with the activation into more activation? Because that's, of course, how we actually resolve the big sympathetic charges, is by allowing them to get to their peak intensity. But again, you got to build the capacity for that, right? So that's why we do the other thing, right? We learn to feel the activation, and then we learn to bring ourselves out of it. Oh, yay, I can venture into this scary neighborhood, and then I can find my way back to safety. And we do that again and again, and eventually we realize, you know what? I can stay present in the dangerous neighborhood because I have enough tools and self-awareness and somatic knowledge and emotional capacity that I can just feel this tremendous threat and feel like I'm gonna die. And at the same time, I know I'm okay, and I'm feeling my butt on the chair and I'm breathing. And at the same time, I'm feeling survival terror. And that's how it processes through. That's how it actually gets out of the system. So we sometimes need to work with the activation instead of only downregulating. That's, of course, your own judgment call. If there is something to do there in that way, it means when you're trying to sleep and you can't, and you're feeling the hypervigilance, you actually get up, you get out of bed, you work with it. I don't remember why the other night, I don't remember what was going on, but something had happened that for some whatever reason, I just couldn't sleep. It wasn't like a deep like trauma thing, but my just system was in, it was just going. It was in sympathetic. I think it had been a really overstimulating day. And laying there trying to sleep was not working. So what do? I get up, I do 10 squats, 10 push-ups, I use my sympathetic juice. And then I went right to sleep, no problem. So we have to sometimes engage with that sympathetic system to help it do what it's wanting to do. And then we can come down. And of course, in the context of trauma, that may also mean emotional processing as well. So. My partner and I have chosen to be child-free. We are traveling and we want to make a positive impact on children in their homes, especially newborns and toddlers. how to connect with them in person and at the same time feel confident they won't be dependent on us if we stay at one place for just a few months. So I think I get what you're saying here. You're traveling, you don't have your own kids. Sounds like you probably have a fair degree of regulation and capacity, and you are looking to connect and be positive sources for kids. That's great. Don't worry about it, essentially, is the answer. Even if you're staying someplace for a month, a positive regulating influence is better than no positive regulating influence. And you're not their parent. Their primary attachment is with their parent. Even if you are a really fun person that's great to have around for a while, and oh, Auntie so and so, Irene was well like this for some kid, Auntie Irene, for the some kids of some friends we have, and she would go, and those parents are totally dysregulated, and like the kids would glom onto her, and while she was there, and then she would leave, and yeah, maybe they'd be a little sad, and then they go on to the next thing. Because if you're a visiting person, you're just not a primary attachment person. So great, go and spread your regulation and don't worry about it. They're going to be fine. And the fact that you can bring them some regulation and some sense of presence and listening and attunement, all that stuff, will only be a positive. I was walking into a building the other day and startled somebody. I felt extremely annoyed and angry. After I went to the bathroom and felt bad. Should I have helped her come down or done more? Is it my energy that was startling? Am I intimidating? All of these thoughts and regrets. I feel a lot of pressure to be of help and be kind in the world, and it feels like a lot of pressure when sometimes I just want to be in my own stuff and not always be the helper. What is happening? What indeed is happening? So much is going on in this question. So, I walked into the building and startled someone. I felt extremely annoyed and angry. Okay, so you startled someone, they got scared, your first response was to feel angry and annoyed. I mean, no judgment, totally get it. And then you went into collapse. Oh, and now I'm sad, I should have helped them. Okay. What's going on here? Their startle response is, again, that startle, that's the initial stage of sympathetic activation. So they got startled, they went into sympathetic activation, you immediately went into sympathetic activation. It sounds like probably what's going on here is at some point you learned that you have to take care of everybody before yourself. Because immediately you're pissed off because, oh my gosh, I just startled them. Now I have to fucking take care of them and help them come down. And then I didn't do that. Now I feel bad because I didn't do that. I didn't take care of them like I'm supposed to, right? So who told you at some point you got to take care of everybody before yourself? That's what's going on here. So where did that come from? That's, I think, the thing you want to discover for yourself. Maybe you already know. Right? But at some point, you learned I have to take care of everybody and my needs are not important. And like you say, I feel a lot of pressure to be helped, to be kind. Like, great. Yeah. I mean, we want to be of help and be kind. But if you feel tremendous pressure, right, to help, it's like, yeah, that is a deep, deep imprint there that says other people's needs are more important than your own. So, yeah, I just want to be in my own stuff. Yeah, you should be. I totally support that. I think that would be fantastic for you to learn to be self-centered, because you clearly have the wiring to help. Don't worry about that. How can you stay focused on your own experience? In this situation, what might that have looked like? It might have looked like you feeling your activation. Okay. And you say to them, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to startle you, and you just move on. You don't have to take care of them, they're in their own stuff, you don't know them, might be intrusive to try to take care of them, right? Like they don't know you. That might feel scary for them. Oh my gosh, I'm so sorry, I didn't mean to startle you. Have a good day, I'm sorry about that. And you just move on. And then you work with what's coming up for yourself. So you ask what's happening, I'm pretty sure that's what's happening. I hope that that's helpful. and provides a little bit of insight. And then it's like, yeah, give yourself permission to focus on yourself. Please, you absolutely are worthy of that and deserve that. Okay. Two questions from the same person here that are quite linked. I first awakened sexual energy that was stagnating somewhere in my pelvis, leading to frustration and then followed by collapse and giving up. Is this a suppressed life force that has no way to move? Should I work with the anger work or annihilation work? It feels connected to my throat also, and somehow it feels more like a block to experiencing pleasure. Can that be? Okay. Question two. Recently, I felt attracted to a guy, and as the connection became available, feelings of disgust to the point I would cringe and sacrifice my boundaries to just reach the connection. How to work on this? It's like my nervous system lit up so much with this hope of receiving love. It's the first time I actually managed to see that and stay with that. Is that the taste of codependency? Okay, so these are actually kind of the same question, I think, ultimately. So yeah, it sounds like there is a block to you feeling and accessing your life energy. And that is because at some point you learned, most likely, that I must suppress my authenticity in order to have the attachment. If this is the classic young person survival dilemma, when we're in a home where we're not supported in being authentic and being in touch with ourselves. So this is that classic Gabor Mate video in the additional resources. If you haven't watched that, definitely go watch that. The need for authenticity. Super, super important. But essentially, as young people, we have two primary drives: the need for connection, attachment, safe attachment, and the need for authenticity. They're both survival needs, but attachment will pretty much always trump authenticity because it's a little bit more important from the survival spectrum. So what we do is we learn I have to suppress my life force, I have to suppress my authenticity in order to maintain the connection. And yes, that is what leads to codependency and all sorts of other relational issues. So yeah, your impulse in, or instinct, I think, in this first question is right. You sense some of your life energy, it was expressing as a sexual energy, but that's just life energy that's mobilizing in the lower body. And that's your life force, and you felt it stirring, and then it felt like it got stuck and then collapsed. Because, yeah, your system learned a pattern of repressing that. And it has nothing to do with sex. It has to do with authenticity in relationship. So this is something that I think, like, to really solidify the kernel of what's going on, it's I have learned to sacrifice my authenticity for the sake of connection. So yeah, your nervous system lit up with the hope of receiving love from this new person. And at the same time, you're feeling the disgust that you already know you're going to sacrifice your boundaries in order to have that connection, right? That's a learned pattern that got learned very, very early on, most likely. So not the best time to actively be in romantic relationships when you're working through these things. But, you know, if that is something that's developing, it hopefully is with full communication and transparency that you're doing this work, because this stuff has got to be part of the conversation. Probably simpler to not have romantic relationships as you're working through these layers specifically. But what you want to do is when you feel these impulses, like, oh my gosh, look at that shiny thing that I really want. Look at this potential love that I can get. You don't act from that place. Don't act from that place. Instead, notice what you're feeling and see what's happening in the body, and maybe do things like, yeah, support your potency, support your authenticity in some way. How do I really feel right now is what needs to be asked as you're experiencing some kind of connection. because this pattern is so deep that, like, oh my gosh, there's love. I'm gonna immediately like throw all this stuff away. And I'm just like, no, pause, feel that. How do you feel that in the body? What's happening? Connect to yourself. Support your authenticity yourself. Maybe do a little bit of potent posture. Feel what it's like. Can you hold a potent posture while feeling these things? That might lead to aggression. Great, work with it. Speak your truth. Just by yourself, speak out loud what you're feeling, or to a mirror, to yourself. Support your inner truth, your authenticity, your reality, and really work on that for a while. And so that you can maintain that even in casual interactions. Like, this may show up in little ways, just in like people where there's no stakes. Like, when you're going through the checkout line, can you maintain a sense of potency in yourself? And yeah, like, you're not trying to shape yourself in any way. You're just being you. You're just feeling yourself. Yeah. Okay, last one. I had a wave of sadness and grief come up this morning. I cried because I haven't been able to do much, and that was good. Sadness and grief are in my throat. Tightness, heat when I cry, and my head seems to fill up with tension, not feeling much below the neck. How to work with the throat and head area. Thank you. Okay. So grief is what we're talking about. And grief, when there's no blocks in the body, is, believe it or not, an expansive experience. It's because grief is so powerful. It's an emotional charge that it wells up through the body. It's like a wave, and just like you gotta just surrender to it. But what how we don't unfortunately get taught that. We get usually taught to manage and pack up our grief, and the body is the thing that has to do that. So that's why you're feeling that constriction, is you're encountering the constriction patterns that are habitually used to manage grief. Because grief, when it fully moves through, it's not like it good is too simple of a word, but it feels powerful and life-giving. And like you move through it, and it's like, wow, there can be a sense of lightness and clarity of having moved this big charge through the system. So that means that you need to work with those somatic blocks. So you can work directly with your head. You can work with that in the same way you do the diaphragm works. If you revisit the diaphragm lessons, you'll see there are three in the head as well. And you can work with those in the same way as you do with the bodily diaphragms. My hunch is, I mean, that may be useful, but I think you also need to work with the respiratory diaphragm. Because you say, you know, you're feeling all this stuff in your head, which are, yeah, classic representations of grief encountering constriction, the tightness in the throat, the heat, the tightness in the head, right? Throbbing, all of that is a classic representation of this. So yeah, you can work there, but also you say you're not feeling anything below the neck. And my hunch is that there might be a lot of stuckness in here, in the respiratory diaphragm. When we really feel grief, we need to sob. And when we sob, the respiratory diaphragm is what has to move. Ha, right? There's a ha. That is the diaphragm moving. And so my hunch is that's not happening. And that getting the diaphragm moving will actually be supportive in allowing the other structures to open as well. So I would support you in, yeah, encourage you in working in both of those areas, the head and also the respiratory diaphragm. And notice just do you have habitual patterns of tightening in the throat, in the jaw? Can you focus on softening those, bringing in some space, all that kind of stuff? Alrighty. So, just one little note here before we move on. Next round will be starting early March. So that's when we will be back in a live session doing all this stuff again. So hope to see you then. And we will end with a little practice. So, this is something I may have forgotten to do this last time, but yeah, I usually like to do this in the last Q&A call. So feel free to go away from the screen or look away or close your eyes. This is a visualization practice, so whatever supports you in doing that is great. So just start with the basics. Just feel your seat, feel your feet. Feel your breath. And as you breathe, just notice the heart space. Is there any sense of expansion and contraction? Can you feel the rhythm of the breath as it moves through the lungs? And as you feel the heart, you feel the breath, just going to focus for a little bit on people and energies, things that we're grateful for. So, any person in your life who has been kind to you, who has offered connection and safety, who's offered wisdom. Even historical figures who have inspired you, healers, sages, poets, musicians. And start to now visualize yourself as a point of light. It's like you're looking at yourself from above, and there's just this beautiful glowing light that you are. There's this orb. And all those people, all those helpful, friendly people, they are popping up around you as little points of light themselves. And they're connected to you by lines, lines of light. And there you are. There you are, just floating, point of light. And you're surrounded by points of light that are connected to you. And just sit with that for a moment and breathe. As your breath comes in, maybe that light gets a little brighter. Maybe it pulses with your breath and is alive. Notice, are you still feeling your butt? Still feeling your feet. See if you can feel your body and see this at the same time. And you're held. It's like you're held in this net of light, of these connections. And now, it's like you're now going to be given the ability to zoom out. And you notice that not only is it you, all of your fellow SBSMers are also there. And each of them is a point of light, surrounded by points of light. All around the globe, all of your friends and fellow students here. All surrounded by their own helpful, friendly people. And you start to see that all of you are connected as well. All of their resource, all of their connection, all of their helpers are also connected to you and yours to them. And it's a net. It's a safety net. It's a net of light. It holds all of us in connection and regulation, shared intention. And just take another breath and thank the light. Thank your helpers, your friendly resourcing people, sources of inspiration. And whenever you feel right, just let that close. Again, just feel yourself, feel your body, connection to the environment. And as you go forward, just know that you're held. You are held in this. It's a very powerful thing, this intention of restoring regulation, of releasing survival energy, healing trauma. Very powerful thing. So anybody who shares this intention is your sister, is your brother. So go forward with that support, and we will see you in the new year. So thank you all, and I'll see you next time.